on CFRC 101.9 FM.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Good evening. It is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, Henry Walker, and Ellie MacArthur. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. On Saturday, January 24th, the Kingston Symphony is inviting audiences to experience one of film's most iconic musical universes, with a concert that dives deep into the legendary scores of Star Wars, from the nine canon films to The Mandalorian, Rogue One, and beyond. From the instantly recognizable themes by John Williams to the newer additions, the music of Star Wars promises a night of cinematic sound at the Kingston Grand Theatre. I spoke with music director Evan Mitchell about this upcoming show in the Symphony's Pop series and why the music of Star Wars continues to resonate generations later.
You've played pieces from Star Wars before, but I don't think ever like this. What made you want to do a full deep dive into the Star Wars universe?
Well, taking a look at things in the aggregate, I've always believed that large-scale cinematic universes, if you'll pardon that term, I know it gets overused quite a bit, they become fairly common. And musically speaking, I would say the one that has the most rich, most impactful, dare I say, the best music is the Star Wars universe. And that's something we've wanted to celebrate for some time. And as a result, given that desire and given the enormous volume of music that exists for the Star Wars universe, it felt like a pretty natural decision.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely one of the most recognizable music worlds in pop culture. What do you think it is about these scores that makes them work so powerfully?
I think an awful lot of credit needs to be given to John Williams. In the original set of Star Wars films, he created a sound world, but even more specifically, a set of musical themes that would define the musical nature of Star Wars at large. And that's something that other composers have had to grapple with, but they've brilliantly added their own stamp onto things as Star Wars has evolved over the decades. But because John Williams started it all and wrote so many incredible themes, I think that that has sort of become part of the DNA of Star Wars, musically speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something that has been a significant reason why the music is so memorable and so closely associated to Star Wars at large.
Mm-hmm. And kind of diving a bit deeper into what you're saying there, everything's very grounded in that original series score. But I was wondering if you could also speak to how it's kind of changed and evolved. I'm sure looking at all these pieces together over the long span of the series has been interesting for you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, particularly take a look at the way things spaced out over the course of since the original trilogy, which spanned from roughly 1977 to 1983, and then going on to the prequel trilogy, which actually had quite a lot of amazing music. That's, I want to say, 1999. To 2000, early 2000s. And then, of course, more than a decade after that, I want to say Force Awakens was about 2016, if memory serves. So there's a huge amount of time for the canon, the nine canon films, spanning from you know, 1977, spanning essentially 45 years. And so that's all musical extensions of the same story, which involved using the same musical themes for the characters who remain and evolve and grow over the course of those 9 films, but also a lot of new and original themes written for the most recent 3 films in the J.J. Abrams trilogy, Force Awakens, and onward. So it's just really interesting. But then beyond that, we have the rest of the cinematic universe, the TV series, the films that are sort of taking place in the nooks and crannies of the Star Wars universe that aren't part of that Skywalker story, the Han Solo film, of course, Rogue One being the very first film, I think, that was in the Star Wars universe that was not including music by John Williams. That's a Michael Giacchino score. We're going to be playing some music from that. The Mandalorian thing was a turning point for what Star Wars could be as part of that television series. We're including music from that as well. And so it's really a quite a tapestry that we're presenting for the Star Wars musical universe at large.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think is different about hearing this music with the full live orchestra compared to experiencing it on the screen or through soundtracks?
Well, first and foremost, by putting the focus on the music and by having it be part of a live concert, music for film and television, by definition, is there as sort of an accompanying aspect. It's there to elevate the film. It's there to enrich an emotional experience or a visceral experience. Or its absence is often there to sort of pinpoint something emotionally in the film. But the point being is that I don't want to say that it's secondary to the film, but it's in service to the film. And when we have the concert proper, when you're just hearing this music and then that becomes the focus, first off, it means you have a little bit more freedom in being able to interpret how fast or slow something should go. Mm-hmm. You're not worrying about having it in sync to picture and to the vision of the director from a cinematography perspective, but it just becomes pure music. And the best film television music stands on its own merits. And of course, all the music that we're going to be performing does that and then some. And so it will draw people into the rich harmonic and sonic soundscapes that the various composers were conjuring up to bring us ever deeper into this world.
And from the podium, I was wondering, what's the biggest difference between conducting film music like this and a traditional classical program?
I wouldn't say there's that much of a difference, particularly if you take a look at John Williams' writes in the grand symphonic tradition. It's really not all that different from conducting a piece from the Romantic era. I think good music is good music. This, I have the extra consideration of thinking about what does this particular passage represent in the film, and do I want to sort of bring that out? Do I want to highlight a character or highlight a sound world or these sorts of things as it relates to the experience of watching it? Because I think a lot of people, what's going to happen is that they'll hear, for example, the opening fanfare, the iconic fanfare. And for them, that will represent the title crawl or the opening of each film, just like the point of introduction to this grand space opera, the opening of it all, you know. So I think about those sorts of things, but it's really, I don't have to stray too far from my quote-unquote classical training, shall we say, because it's music is very much written in that vein. It just has a specialized purpose originally in mind. And so as long as I'm thinking about that also, then it's very similar.
And what can audiences expect walking into this concert next weekend?
It's a celebration of the music that they know and love. It's a celebration of a great cross-section of the entire Star Wars universe. As I've mentioned, we include all 9 of the music from all 3 of the trilogies. We have music from The Mandalorian. We have music from Rogue One. So it's, in a sense, it's an attempt to showcase some of the very best and most memorable and beloved music from this franchise performed live And there's something about a live performance, of course, as we all know, it's an experience unto itself. So just going to have a great time. And we're going to be having a great time as well, being immersed in such wonderful music. It's a concert we're all looking forward to.
And you don't have to answer specifically if you feel like it'd be too much of a spoiler, but I was wondering if you personally had any tracks that you're specifically really looking forward to.
Look, I love all this music, and I was the one who put this program together. So I will often curate things that I think people want to hear this and people should hear this. That's my primary concern rather than I want to perform this. But there's so much wonderful music from just this. It's an incredible treasure trove of just hours upon hours upon hours of music. And we're really lucky that it's been published in its original format. That's something to bear in mind, that we're not doing reductions or arrangements of this music. This is all from the signature series of Star Wars music. So these are the original cues from the films. And the way that you hear them will be the way that you remember them from the films. So I will say that I am particularly impressed with how John Williams was able to continue his sort of excellence with the most recent trilogy of films. You will be performing some music from The Force Awakens. And I think that some of the best music in the Star Wars universe was composed for The Force Awakens. And so it's going to be a particular joy for me to be able to showcase that.
That was Evan Mitchell, music director with the Kingston Symphony. The music of Star Wars takes place Saturday, January 24th, 2026 at the Kingston Grand Theater as part of the Symphony's Pops series. Tickets are available at kingstonsymphony.ca or through the Grand Theater box office. The Food Policy Council for KFLNA is continuing its work towards a comprehensive regional food strategy, launching a series of 5 targeted focus groups over the coming weeks. In collaboration with Queen's University and other community partners, the council is embarking on consultations designed to better understand what communities across Kingston, Frontenac, Lennox, and Addington need in order to build a sustainable and equitable local food system. These consultations will take a deeper dive into 5 key areas: rural food production, urban food production, food security, food retail and distribution, and food education and literacy. The first consultation, focused on rural food production, including farmers and market gardeners, took place on Monday. Members of the Food Policy Council co-chair Ellen Mortfield and Queen's University School of Environmental Studies assistant professor Kristen Lowett sat down to discuss the launch of the consultation process and what it aims to achieve. Mortfield explained what's led the council to this stage in its work.
It's been quite a few years building to this point. Last year, working with Kristen and Queen's University, the Food Policy Council did secure a bit of funding to launch us on this process of starting a food strategy for Kingston, Frontenac, Lennox, and Addington. So we've been slowly building. We had some more casual potluck events over the summer just to get the conversation started. And now we're conducting these kind of targeted focus groups with specific sectors within the food system. So last night was our first one with the rural food production folks. We had a good turnout. I think there's about 20, wasn't there, Kristen?
Yeah, I think probably, 14, 15 producers?
Yeah, yeah. And really interesting conversations, lots of ideas. We started to work towards prioritizing some of those ideas, some action items that we'll be able to pursue. And all of these sort of ideas and goals and objectives and action plans will be set out in the finished food strategy. But at this stage, we're just trying to make note of these ideas, get people connected so we can start pursuing some of these action items, and really make some significant improvements over the next few years in people's access to local food in this area. That's the big goal.
Following several informal meetings over the summer and now one completed consultation, Lowett says the council is already beginning to identify key themes emerging from the discussions. Among them, the importance of connection across different sectors of the food system and the notion of building food sovereignty in the region.
we did begin, I'll step back for a second, right, in terms of slightly bigger context. So the Food Policy Council has been around since just over 10 years, since around 2013. And I think its mandate when it started was to, you know, contribute to the community food system in this region. And I think over the summer and the informal potluck series you're referring to, and then, you know, the first session we're having now, I think one of the biggest takeaways, at least for myself personally, is just like the importance of these sorts of forums or events for convening and gathering people in food systems that may not always have a chance to connect or speak to one another. And there's lots of reasons for that. I mean, people are busy, but there's also, you know, a lot of fragmentations, you know, between, you know, farmers or policymakers or people that are eating food or even teachers that might be teaching or whatever, right? So often there isn't really a way for a lot of these different actors to connect. And so I think that's been really powerful just in terms of sharing ideas. With, you know, with the farmers and food producers last night, for example, you know, it became clear pretty quickly. There were some shared, you know, issues, concerns sort of in common, right? We had an extended kind of conversation about, you know, distribution and how do we scale up distribution of regional foods, right? And some common challenges experienced with respect to, you know, building a bigger pool of customers and, you know, distributing more widely, right? So I think there's a really big need for these sort of convening. And that's kind of really what the Food Policy Council was meant to do, right? Because too often, you know, food is really sort of, the food system's often really kind of fragmented in terms of policy, you know, like health has a piece over here and then maybe agriculture somewhere else. And often, you know, it's under economic development or whatever, there often isn't a more integrated forum for discussing some of these issues and bringing them together and connecting some of the pieces. And so this summer was really valuable for that because we had folks from across the food system to coming together. The focus group similarly, although we're focusing a little bit deeper now on kind of, you know, specific sort of aspects or questions and kind of groups in the food system. So I think that to me is one of the big takeaways and one of the big values. And, you know, the second would be, I think, related to that is hopefully, you know, this notion of sort of building food sovereignty, right? And in the kind of the larger food system, there's such a lack of control for farmers or fishers or eaters, right? Often in terms of, you know, where's the food coming from, who's growing it, who has control of inputs or seed supplies, you know, farmers being more, you know, price takers and these sorts of things, right? And being squeezed in different ways in value chains and just corporations and governments that are often, you know, complicit with what they want. Really not responding to the need of, you know, communities, of localities, of regional, more ecological food production, I want to call it that. So I think, that need to convene and hopefully feel like, I think the local and the regional scales are really powerful in terms of building some of those connections, discussing shared issues and thinking about, you know, what can we do here? What are the assets and values we have here that allow us to build the food system in a more kind of food sovereign, you know, food system that the community, you know, kind of collectively wants.
As mentioned, the council has already gained insight into some of the key challenges and has begun brainstorming potential solutions based on feedback from participants in the first session.
We'll see the commonalities, I think, once we get more of the groups going. But in this first one, I think it was interesting to see some of the ideas that came out. Just people, you know, with this shared experience of in local food production. Some of the things that were talked about is like a food hub or a food cooperative. Is that something that would be helpful to our farmers? Also, some of the issues, like one of our biggest problems here is not enough food being produced locally. Farmers are kind of aging out of the system and they're not being replaced by young people coming into farming. So that's an issue there. And then other things like difficulties with local bylaws and the differences in enforcement and bylaws, even in between the counties, like Lennox and Addington and Frontenac counties, have different ways of dealing with growth in food production and farm businesses. And so those are the sorts of difficulties that the folks that came out to participate last night, those are the kinds of things that they were talking about.
Looking ahead, Mortfield and Lowitz say the next steps will be analyzing the information gathered and beginning to develop concrete action items once the sessions wrap up in early February.
Our hope is that we can kind of prioritize some of these ideas and actions on, you know, the quick wins, the ones that are going to take a few years of work. And we need to identify who needs to be involved to move these forward. And there's lots of work to be done, but setting some goals, you know, having a 2-year plan, a 5-year plan, a 10-year plan, and people at the table that are willing to tackle some of these, that's what we want to achieve out of these sessions.
Yeah, I mean, some of these, you know, the discussions, these focus groups have started to, you know, we've done kind of some of the larger sort of visioning exercises, and now we're really starting to focus on, you know, some of the concrete and tangible actions that communities, organizations, citizens in the food system can take and would like to see. So we've started to do some of that kind of actioning and prioritizing. And I think there's a lot of really, you know, concrete kind of proposals that came up even just in the session last night, right? Like, for example, is there potential to establish a food hub? We spent some time talking about, you know, a cooperative grocery store. There's another really tangible example. We had a representative from CASI, the Kingston Area Seed Saving Initiative in attendance, who, you know, really was encouraging members of the community to grow out some of their local and traditional seeds, right? That's a really tangible action, right? That gardeners or school gardeners or farmers can take up, right? So I think we have some really kind of tangible examples, and there's, you know, it's fantastic for our council too, because I think this is the start of a process, right? It's sort of a food strategy, so then we can also identify, you know, some of these, you know, short, medium term, maybe longer term sort of policy actions or initiatives that we want to kind of collectively sort of work on or continue to convene, right, with these other groups in the food system and try to move ahead, right, coming out of this food strategy process.
Several consultations are still on the horizon. The Urban Food Production Consultation, focused on community gardeners, urban agriculture, and food forests, takes place Monday, January 19th from 5 to 8 p.m. The Food Security Consultation, centered on charitable and emergency food access, will follow on Monday, January 26th from 5 to 8 p.m. Food retail and distribution, including restaurants and local food outlets and markets, will be the focus on Monday, February 2nd from 5 to 8 p.m. The final consultation on food education and literacy involving school boards, public health, and educators takes place Monday, February 9th from 5 to 8 p.m. Community researcher Ayla Fenton is coordinating all 5 sessions. Those interested in participating in a consultation relevant to their work are encouraged to contact her at aylafoodpolicykfla@gmail.com. That's aylafoodpolicykfla@gmail.com. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. This is Henry Walker with your Queens Campus News here on CFRC 101.9's Campus Beat. Queen's University is among 6 Ontario post-secondary institutions receiving provincial funding to support the expansion of primary care teaching clinics. Under the Provisional Primary Care Action Plan, a total of $8 million has been allocated for planning new and expanded clinic operations, which aim to connect more patients with family doctors and interdisciplinary healthcare teams. Queen's operates Family Health Team Primary Care Clinics in Kingston, Belleville, and Oshawa, and the recent funding will support planning work at each site. The initiative is intended to improve access to primary care while training future health professionals, including resident physicians and other practitioners working in team-based care settings. In related provincial news, the government of Ontario has announced a significant investment in colleges and universities, with $242 million designated for upgrading facilities and institutional equipment across the province. The announcement was made in Kingston by the Minister of Colleges, Universities, Research Excellence, and Security. Most of the funding is allocated through the Facilities Renewal Program, which supports maintenance and repair on-campus buildings. Additional funds will help purchase modern instruction and training equipment. Officials say the investment is intended to better align post-secondary institutions with workforce needs in sectors such as healthcare, trades, and education. On January 14th, Queen's University held a ceremony to honor Chancellor Emeritus and former Senator Murray Sinclair. Sinclair, the first Indigenous Chancellor in Queen's history, was recognized for his long-standing work in promoting reconciliation and Indigenous justice. The event drew attention from both the Queen's community and broader civic audiences, making a connection of the university's efforts to recognize leadership in equity and community service. In Kingston municipal politics, a recently published commentary has urged caution in adopting online voting for the upcoming 2026 municipal election. The piece argues that while online voting may expand accessibility, it also raises unresolved concerns around cybersecurity, equity, and trust in electoral outcomes. Local residents and policy analysts will likely continue this debate as municipal councils consider options ahead of the election. The Kingston area continues to see development proposals, with plans being discussed for a high-volume residence project downtown on a block formerly home to a McDonald's and Blockbuster video store. The proposal, described by municipal officials as consistent with the city's intensification goals, has promoted debate among community members about height, density, and heritage impacts in the core. Looking ahead, Queen's University's Department of Gender Studies is hosting the 2026 SXGD Lecture on January 28th at Robert Sutherland Hall. The talk, delivered by Dr. Natalie Curry-Tau, will explore institutional dynamics of safety and power in higher education. Also in the coming days, the Kingston Grand Theatre continues performances of Into the Woods, now running through January 20th, offering cultural programming that attracts both students and community audiences. I've been Henry with your Queen's Campus News here on CFRC 101.9 FM.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. We start with Monday, January 19th, daytime high of -5, feeling closer to -16 with the wind chill. We're also looking at a little bit of snow overnight, could see 3 to 6 centimeters falling between late Sunday and the rest of the day Monday. Tuesday, January 20th, another very chilly day. Daytime high of -10, feeling closer to -20 with the wind chill, and another 1 to 3 centimeters in the forecast between Tuesday night and the morning of Wednesday, January 21st. Slightly warmer, -6, feeling like -15, with intermittent snow and flurries projected throughout the day. Thursday, January 22nd, daytime high of -6 with a mix of sun and cloud, feeling closer to -11 with the wind chill. Friday, January 23rd, a little bit colder, daytime high of -9. But we will see less wind chill, so in the sun at the peak of the day, it'll actually feel a little closer to -4, even if the temperature is technically forecasted to be lower than Thursday. Saturday, January 24th, -8 is your high. Snowy, cold, feeling like -17. Sunday, January 25th, -14, with a wind chill feeling closer to -20. A little bit of sun, mostly clouds in the forecast. And then moving into the start of next week, Monday, January 26th, high of -11, feeling like -20, with a 60% chance of snow in the forecast as well. This week's City of Kingston traffic report has very little to report, but I do want to remind our listeners that the full winter parking restrictions went into effect on January 1st. During January and February, Overnight on-street parking is not permitted, no matter the weather conditions. That will change in March, where overnight on-street parking will be banned only if the weather and conditions require it, so think particularly snowy or icy evenings. When restrictions are in place, parking on city streets is prohibited from 1 a.m. to 7 a.m. On the streets surrounding Kingston General Hospital, the ban runs from 12 a.m. to 7 a.m. Vehicles left on the street during bans are subject to ticketing and towing. To learn more about parking restrictions, how they work, and to stay informed, you can visit the City of Kingston website.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. This is edition 300, and I'm Stefan Christoff. On the broadcast this week, a conversation with André Penchado. André speaks about his work, both as an educator, but also as a visual artist photographer in Brazil. I think it's a valuable conversation for a couple of reasons. The first is it really depicts a voice thinking about the textures of Brazilian society today, a very important, space that has seen a lot of contestation towards the Trump version of Western culture and economics under the present government of Lula da Silva. André, as an artist, I think speaks to the layered thoughtfulness of a lot of Brazilian artists today. He speaks about a number of projects, including efforts to explore and address more contentious elements of Brazilian history, including uprisings in the north of enslaved communities not far from the city of Belém. It was really a pleasure to speak with André about his work as a photographer today in Brazil for Free City Radio. Here's our exchange. Documenting social life and sort of the textural realities of Brazil today is, as always, could require a multitude. André, your photography really speaks to the broad diversity of textures that make up Brazilian life. And you're based in Sao Paulo, but of course, the country itself is massive, and I think also lends itself and creates an opening really that speaks to photography because of how diverse the textures and terrains and also society is. Like the social life even in your city is radically different neighborhood to neighborhood. We can get into some of your specific projects, but maybe first can you just introduce yourself and maybe share a little bit of a window into your photography practice. You also are an educator.
Well, my name is André Penchado. I'm a 54-year-old visual artist based in São Paulo. I work primarily in photography and video. I've been working with photography. Firstly, I was a commercial photographer for a long time. So I was a commercial photographer from 1998 until 2013, roughly. But in from 2010 onwards, I became more interested in developing my own projects, and then I quite left commercial photography, and I've been doing that since then. And then also 8 years ago I started teaching, but you know, when I talk about teaching with people that live in the US or in Canada, people always ask if I teach in a university or something like that, but it's not what I do. I just have groups in my studio in São Paulo, people that want to develop projects in photography, that like the kind of work I do. So for instance, in this semester, I have 45 people in different groups, in different formats. They come to my place or do it online, where I share basically my experience and my way of working with them, and then I guide them through the development of their own projects. If I want to talk about the kind of photography I do, it's interesting that you mentioned that I do have different styles, and this is true. I love photography as a medium, and I think about the style I'm going to use for a project depending on the idea of the project, the concept for the project. So it changes. As a commercial photographer, I practice lots of different types of photography, and also and I use that in my practice. As I haven't studied photography properly, I'm self-taught. I went to business school, and I also did social science. Actually, it wasn't business school, because it was management school for the state, if you want to work as a civil servant. So it's a kind of school for that. I don't know how to call that properly in English, but it's within the business school, but it was a management school. And I love the way photography, because you've been saying things about the texture of Brazil, and it's interesting also because I love the way photography records the surface of the world. I think photography has this kind of complexity where it records the surface of the world in its minimum detail, at least the kind of photography I do many times, you know, like direct straight photography. But regardless of that, there's a void of meaning in it if you don't know what's been photographed, if you don't know the story behind it, if you don't know the people in the photo. You don't get almost anything, you know. You can describe the person, you can describe the place, but you actually don't know anything. So it's a complex medium, right? Because it says a lot without saying anything many times. And I like this in my work, so I try to create many times visual... I lost the word. But I like to use photography to investigate facts of Brazilian history, and also facts that happen in my personal life, but I think that they can resonate in society. For instance, the loss of my father to suicide. So what is to deal with a loss like that, and how can I use photography trying to express the different feelings and experience that I had from the moment I got the news that my father had killed himself. And so many times I invite people to work with me. So I did a project with people that had suicide in their families as well. So I share my experience and ask people to share the experience with me. And then we create images that can become metaphors for the feelings or emotions that we had. And I also use photography in another large scale project. And it's called, in English, it's called Trails, Traces, and Vestiges, if you translate from Portuguese, in which I investigate facts of Brazilian history that happened before the invention of photography. So they are all from the 19th century. And I chose two revolutions and facts related to the history of art in Brazil, and I do straight photography in all those cases, trying to capture how these facts still reverberate in the present. So many times I come from the point where personal emotions or experience are very complex, and we try to understand the world, so we create a narrative, and that also happens in historical facts, where they're very complex, and then we create a narrative to be able to understand the present, but also we reduce a lot the complexity of everything.
You described two elements of your work. The first element, when you're talking about educational classes, there's a collectivity there. which I think is very striking, but also this group project that you described about people who have had loss in their families. There's a collectivity. Both of those things speak to the last point that you were talking about, which is making meaning of the world. And photography in terms of assuring or defining a context that is collectively understood around those images, it can be assisting in that process of making a meaning. And so I would just ask you about that, because I think that in this particular moment in the world, that meaning making outside of American hegemony is important, because we're not benefiting collectively the earth on an ecological level, but also us as people around the world don't benefit from a sort of hegemonic meaning, right? And so those spaces of collectivity in the arts, I think, are important in terms of people finding other meanings of experience. And thankfully, Brazil is a reference point where we do see different meanings and understandings of how society should function, governance, collective understanding.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. You know, and I've been discussing with one of my students that has, he works in the government, in the São Paulo city, right? And the government, or the mayor, well, I don't know how to say that, but he works in the House of Representatives of São Paulo. And how we could maybe turn photo books into something that used in schools to teach people how to read complex narratives of images and try to understand more what's being fed to them all the time via social media and everything, you know. When people come to study with me, they sometimes they come with very personal stories they want to turn into an art project. And the whole work we do is how to find the common ground in the work, right? It's not only about them, but it's how we can use that to share something in society. And then when I work with Brazilian history, it's more about seeing what's been left behind, what is not in the main narrative, you know, the vestiges of something else, and also trying to help people understand how everything is just a built narrative, right? So facts happened, but there are so many of them, and then there's this consensus of the powerful narrative that just go over everything and says that's what happened, you know. But that's I think the internet and social media have become a place where they're using it all the time to just like push their agendas, right? So I think in Brazil, even though the right is still very powerful here, you know, you have a country that they almost got it there again last time, no? And it's very hard. I think, you know, what is hard for me to think and try to come up with a solution is that how can we, using the tools that control by the people in power, can make the other narratives spread, right? Because for instance, I use Instagram as a way helping me selling my courses, you know, showing, promoting the kind of work I do. But if I could, I wouldn't be there whatsoever, you know, because it's a horrible platform. You know, it's like you just see ads all the time. They manipulate the algorithm so much. So sometimes I do feel that we have to try to find a different way of making our ideas go around, you know, because we cannot be attached to the tools of the people that are just oppressing everyone anyway, you know. But how can we find these other tools, and how can we have resources to create them, you know? One of the things that I think is more important in my life now are the days where I can just leave my phone somewhere else and just not look at it, because it became just a tool of controlling time, right? I don't know if I answer you, I just went in a different path maybe, but this is something that I think a lot. You know, I just bought a book by a German group against the idea of work the way we do it, you know, about the necessity of working in this kind of format that we have now, you know. And also I was reading a book by a British psychologist on giving up, it's not giving, the translation wouldn't be giving up, but it's about not, I've been thinking a lot, Stefan, I would really like to hear you on that too. It's about giving up this way of living, you know. It's not even just like fighting. It's not quite quitting as well. It's a different thing. I couldn't get my head around it properly. But it's when we just give up these tools. They are like kind of making us believe that they're really cool and nice and help us work. And also it's just working a different way. It's finding different ways of connecting, finding different ways of surviving, finding different ways of making a living without being attached to this kind of system that we know doesn't work. And that also works for the art world, right? It's just being there, right? It's just like, what is the art world if not connected to the super rich, to, you know, to the whole system? So how can we be artists and also make a living? And I mean, I have this idea that in a world that I believe no one would just be an artist full time, you know, we all have to contribute somewhere else, like teaching, building, growing food and stuff, and also being artists, because the idea of an artist, that artist 24/7 and just make a living from that is too much connected to the idea that we need someone that has enough money to buy that. I don't know if you agree with that, but I think a lot about that. Well, how artists how can we change the way we make a living and can still be artists, but not connected just to the super rich?
One term that I've been hearing people in Brazil mention is digital sovereignty, right? And this idea of other ecosystems of communication, which I think is also being echoed in different parts of the world. And I think this is important just to respond to your point about how we communicate. The physicality of a lot of your work, whether it's in education or also bringing people into physical spaces where you're sharing printed material, the relationship to an image and the sort of social encounter around an image, it creates a different condition because there's a sort of shared experience there. Maybe you could just highlight a few of the recent exhibitions you've worked on, maybe one that speaks to your work, and also just the fact that you've chosen to share that in a public setting, and why.
Well, I was part of an exhibition that happened at Ocupação 9 de Julho. That happened. Let me just check the dates here, because it's been a while. Let me see if. Yeah, it happened. Yeah, 2023. It's called Refundação. And I had three, it was a group show. And I also, I really think group shows are better than solo shows, you know, because you have different works connected and it can create different meaning. I mean, I had some solo shows and in that context I like them. But I think Refundação was an exhibition that had many different layers that were very interesting, because it happened in Ocupação 9 de Julho. Do you know it? Yeah. How would you explain that in English?
So we're talking about a space of a former public building in downtown Sao Paulo that has been occupied by people demanding housing justice, the occupation of July 9th, it's called, where there's an art gallery space within that occupation of the building. But thank you for mentioning it. Please go ahead.
Yeah, and they create, the idea of having an art gallery there was a way of putting objects there that were really valuable. So that would prevent the police when breaking in, because in Brazil, if they try to reclaim the building and if they break things that belong to the people that are living there, they have to pay for it. So if you have an artwork that's very expensive, so some big names in Brazilian art donate works to be there, you know. So some of them donated, it was, they were sold, and then the money stayed for the ocupação. But then, so they created this, that was the second exhibition there, where they invited like hundreds of artists from different backgrounds, different areas, different kinds of work. They weren't all just like top contemporary artists, you know. They mixed several different types of works, and that was something that was very pleasant to be part, because it felt more like the real world, you know. The building is a bit derelict, so wasn't a perfect gallery, you know. And I think the artworks were alive there, because all the social context, you know, so everything was very meaningful. And then after that, this exhibition was taken to a museum that is in Ouro Preto. Ouro Preto is a town in the countryside of Minas Gerais, where they found, I think, the largest amount of gold in Brazil in the 18th and 19th century. The gold went to Portugal, right? And it's a museum that is interesting because it's supposed to be a historical museum, but because they don't have many artifacts from... It's called Museu da Inconfidência. Inconfidência was an upheaval that happened there against the empire, you know. But there's not many documents or objects related to that. So in a way, it's a museum that has more like furniture and, you know, this kind of... museums, or the museum of how people lived in the 18th and 19th century. But it's a museum that the right likes, because it kind of tells a story, a part of Brazilian history that they kind of attach it to, you know. There's this hero of the Brazilian history called Tiradentes, and there's lots of religious images there, you know, because it was a very religious place, so there are lots of saints and things. And then they took this exhibition. The museum director is a new director, and he's trying to change the museum. He's doing an amazing work trying to turn it into a museum that questions Brazilian history. You know, he comes from a philosophy background. He used to teach philosophy in the university in Brasilia, but then he applied and got the job to become the director of this museum, and he's changing everything. So one thing he did was to take this exhibition from Ocupação 9 de Julho to the museum, to occupy the museum, and to be mixed with these objects from the 19th century and things, and became a very interesting exhibition. And then was a lot of protest against it from the conservative movement, you know, saying, oh, they're destroying the museum, what are they doing, you know, because they adding this work close to these sacred images and stuff. So these were two exhibitions that I was really happy to take part in. And I also had a solo show in Belém in the north. That was 2024, and I took, it was a solo show about cabanagem. Cabanagem is my work that I did there in Belém. Cabanagem is the largest revolution that ever happened in Brazil, you know, with the largest numbers of dead, around 30,000 people were murdered by the imperial army. And when they rebelled, they killed the governor of the state. This is very unusual in Brazilian history, you know. They took over power, they seized power for a year in the capital, and then the imperial government spent 5 years chasing the revolutionaries in the Amazon jungle and killed them. You know, the soldiers would come back to Belém with necklaces of ears. They would cut off people they killed, just to prove how many people they killed, you know. And cabanagem is a known story in the region, but it's not known in the rest of Brazil. So I made a book in 2015. where I visited places that had a connection to the history of cabanage, where battles happened or where people were kept prisoners and things like that, you know, or cemeteries where people are buried, and the farm that belonged to one of the leaders of the revolution. And I just saw what I do when I do projects like that is that I do a lot of research, I interview people, historians, economists to understand. I read several books and I come up with a list of possible images, ways of connecting the past with the present. And then I go to these places and then I see what's there, and then the images happen at the time when I get there. It's not that I can think about an image, I can know that I should go somewhere to see what is there. And that became a book. A photo book. It's actually two photo books and a small newspaper that come inside an envelope, like a document envelope. And there's no captions for the pictures of the place I go, so it's about forgetting as well. So every picture has a connection to the history of cabanage, but I don't say what's the connection. But I have captions for the portraits, which are in the smaller book. And I was invited by the Bienal das Amazonas, Amazon Biennial. They have it's a lovely institution that was created by Livia Conduru, who's an amazing person who's just like doing everything without any support from the governments of the state. So she managed to raise funds and do an amazing work there. They are having the second biennial this year, and I did it last year where I was like in between biennials. They have other exhibitions happening, and that was really interesting because it was the first time I was able to show these photographs there, and the curator decided not to have like a regular show with like large prints as I do, but to have this kind of cloud of images in the room, and then also to have my work in dialogue with works from artists from Belém that touched in the same subject. It's interesting that in a way they call it like a solo show, because it was like my work was the main work, but actually it was a group show with two other artists and also a coin from the time. So it was like an object that would connect direct from the past. There was a coin created by the Cabanos, by the revolutionaries, no, for their government. And that was something that was very pleasing to do, you know, just like to be there, to talk to people. When I do exhibitions, I like to stay several days in the room and talk to people that come in and discuss the work and see how they can relate to the work, you know, if they like it, if they see what is there, what you know. So I think that's it.
Well, as I imagined, without the details, what you've shared does open up possibilities to understand different experiences and worlds and collective encounters, both in the past and also related to your work as an educator and photographer, but also in terms of unpacking mainstream understandings of history of Brazil. And I think for people to sort of understand and think about how what you've shared can also open questions about their own respective environments and political histories, but also thinking about how artistic practices can be a mechanism or sort of like a medium through which to explore these things. It's really lovely to speak to you today. Thank you so much.
Yes, it's a pleasure.
That was a conversation with Brazilian photographer André Penchado for Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in. We broadcast weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m., on CJLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Wednesdays at 8 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m., on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m., on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m., on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m., on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m., on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Thursdays at 4:30 p.m., and on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m.
You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. We are also a podcast. Look us up. Just search Free City Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Stefan Christoph, and we'll be with you next week.